KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in False Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Akutan, Alaska.
Welcome to the Bioneers, revolution from the heart of nature and the human heart.
It's all alive. It's all connected. It's all intelligent. It's all relatives.
Indigenous women go missing three times in life, in the media, and in the data. And so that invisibility of who we are and what we're going through, it contributes to the lack of attention paid to us when we go missing or we are murdered.
But now we've seen women standing up and rising up and saying, no more, we're not gonna be the silent role. We have to have a voice. We have to have our own grassroots organizations and take a stand and maybe help pick up our men that lost their warrior status when the industries came and colonization came, because we don't have a choice.
In this program, powerful Native women leaders first reveal the crisis of missing and murdered Indigenous women, and then describe how they're taking action and building growing movements, including with non-Native allies. Morningstar Gali, Ozawa Benishi Albert, Simone Sinogles, Candy White, and Casey Camp Horneck. This is No More Stolen Sisters, Stopping the Abuse and Murder of Native Women and Girls. I'm Neil Harvey, I'll be your host. Welcome to the Bioneers, revolution from the heart of nature. Jessica Alva, Khadija Rose Britton, Hannah Harris, Anthonette Christine Cayadito. If you haven't heard of these women, it's no surprise. They are four of the untold number of Indigenous women and girls who've been murdered, kidnapped, or gone mysteriously missing. A significant number of victims are from communities that are subjected to the harmful presence of fossil fuel and mining companies. The extractive industry is ravaging Native nations where oil and blood have long run together. Oil workers, mostly men, live in housing units commonly called man camps. They're notoriously dangerous places for Indigenous women and girls. Add to this a dysfunctional police and legal hierarchy that leaves Indigenous women and their families with little support during the first crucial hours when they go missing, and little recourse to prosecute predators for their crimes. As Lisa Brunner, a member of the White Earth Ojibwe Nation and a longtime victims advocate, says, what's happened through U.S. federal law and policy is they created lands of impunity where this is like a playground for serial rapists, batterers, and killers, and our children aren't protected at all. While some news outlets report on these tragedies, each headline eventually fades and the stories have gone mostly unheard.
According to a recent study, police in many U.S. cities fail to track murdered, missing Indigenous women.
According to the U.S. Department of Justice, Indigenous women are 10 times more likely to be murdered than the national average.
One estimate based on national crime data pegs the number of missing Native women and girls at more than 5,700 in 2016 alone, though reliable data is near impossible to come by.
What are we missing here? What's happening?
These stories are shocking, harrowing, and heartbreaking. But then again, when your heart breaks, the cracks are where the light shines through. Morningstar Gali is a member of the Pitt River Indian Tribe of California. She's a lifelong Indigenous rights activist and born into a family who has fought for the rights of Native peoples in California and beyond. As part of her organizing work addressing the ongoing missing and murdered Indigenous women crisis, she provides direct support to victims' families.
We held a prayer gathering and a press conference outside of San Francisco City Hall. And we held it for a sister of mine that was murdered 6 months ago. And her death has been ruled as a suicide. And we are pushing within the DA's office, within the city officials to conduct a full investigation. We had for 3 days while she was on life support and had people coming in to pray and offer those songs and offer those ceremonies. And it was made very clear, it was very evident that she was Native. And yet on her death certificate, her race was still listed as unidentifiable. And in her death, it was her partner. There was a history of domestic violence. He had given a fake name. He was not on the lease, and he was allowed to stay in her apartment, clean up the crime scene, called it into the ambulance as a suicide. And that's what the San Francisco Police Department went by. And so they failed in every way possible. There's been a number of deaths. We are very much still grieving. We are very much in disbelief that this is the work that we are doing. And yet it's our sisters that are being directly impacted. And so we spend a lot of our time just going to meet with families and listening to them and sitting with them in support and prayer, you know, just letting them know that we are doing whatever we can, just as community members, as people that are also affected by this, to help to hold them in that love and in that support and helping to get the word out about their family members.
Across the nation, many police forces do not take serious what is happening to Indigenous women. Disappearances, murders are often dismissed and they're not prioritized.
Ozawa Banishi Albert is an Oklahoma-based Native rights and environmental justice advocate. A leader from the Yuchi and Anishinaabe nations, she works on global collaborations to strengthen grassroots feminist movements. Up close and personal, she witnesses how police departments and courts disappear these women just as surely as the perpetrators who kill them.
There was a case where they found a woman tied and bound in a ditch with no shoes, but they have deemed it no foul play, right? So I lost an auntie a couple years ago, a block and a half from her house, killed on the train tracks. And the police have deemed it an accidental death of an alcoholic person, right? That she would make a decision to choose to sit on a train track and drink, as what they're proposing. Her house, warm, was a block and a half away, right? But they're like, oh no, there was no murder, no foul play. So there's also this policy of practice that's part of that culture of saying, like, women are lesser than, and Indigenous women are even lesser than that. We're not wasting our resources to investigate murders of Indigenous women, which is why the creation of a database has not happened from any criminal justice system. It's happened from Indigenous communities saying, we need to create a database because police forces, FBI, they're not doing it.
The nonprofit Sovereign Bodies Institute is the first organization to document how Indigenous people are impacted by gender and sexual violence and maintains the most thorough and accurate database on missing and murdered Indigenous women in the United States. In a single year, in 2016, nearly 5,700 Indigenous women were reported missing. Only 2% of those cases even made it to the records of the U.S. Department of Justice, according to a study by the Urban Indian Health Institute. Altogether, Indigenous women experience 10 times higher rates of violence, murder, sex trafficking, and abuse than women of other ethnicities. And statistically, a great number of these crimes are happening in communities where oil and mining workers are housed in so-called man camps. Candy White with the Indigenous Environmental Network lives in Montana and is a member of the three affiliated tribes, Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara. Living in her ancestral homeland, Candy has witnessed firsthand how blood and oil mix with misogyny and racism, and there's little if any protection from the law.
all these thousands of men came from all over the world and set up like little shanty towns, really. Some of them were RV trailers, some of them were just like cars people were living in. They would work long hours, roughnecking, they call it. And then when they had downtime, they weren't with their families. So they would either go to the bars, they would start using or abusing drugs. All of that led to our community having a 168% increase in the violence against women. We started seeing women being raped. We started seeing women as young as 13, maybe even 12, selling themselves. They would go into man camps willingly, and then they would get raped, and there would be nowhere to turn to for them. There was just story after story after story of sex trafficking. People tried to kidnap our children and put them into the sex trade. Fracking fractured our communities. It divided us. Like, it's not the same. Whenever I go home, it's like all these strangers are everywhere, and there's a bunch of them unemployed now because the price of oil went down, and so they're waiting for the oil boom to go again. And people that have money either are fighting with those that don't have it, or they left because they can afford to leave. And a lot of broken families were left behind. And so women are left trying to pick up the pieces.
Another serious obstacle for women and families seeking justice is that tribal courts are highly constrained in their ability to prosecute crimes committed by non-tribal citizens on their lands, because of complex jurisdictional restrictions that disempower tribal governance and sovereignty. Again, Ozawa Benishi Albert.
This is a policy that is applied to Indian people, but is a policy of the nation of American citizens. It's going to take a political will larger than what Indian people can hold their own. We have other really good policies, but have failed Indigenous nations, right? So the Violence Against Women Act. The last time it was reauthorized was the very first time they included language for tribal nations to be able to prosecute someone for domestic violence, which was a huge gain for Indigenous peoples. 239 Indigenous nations of Alaska were excluded from being able to have that same power to prosecute someone non-native in their tribal lands.
In 2013, when Congress reauthorized the Violence Against Women Act, or VAWA, it restored the authority of tribal courts to prosecute domestic violence crimes. But this hard-won legal authority still doesn't apply to all Native nations or to all violent crimes, including rape or murder. Another catch is the onerous burden of criteria that Indigenous courts and law enforcement bodies are required to meet to try these cases. Many tribes simply don't have the necessary resources, even with federal grants. Since VAWA was amended, just 24 out of 600 federally recognized tribes have been able to build the infrastructure required to try domestic violence cases. As a result, some Indigenous women don't even bother to report the crimes. The ones who do report them often find their cases passed along to the FBI, where they languish. Casey Camp Horanek is a respected elder and leader of the Ponca tribe of Oklahoma. As a culture bearer, she knows well the hidden history of Native peoples.
We had our ways in the past. If there was a kind of man around that was abusive, he was shunned and put away from the people, had to leave the people and live out on his own. The woman was taken in by other women for her healing until she became whole again. We don't know what happened to the men because they weren't allowed to ever be around us again. Now, when we have the extractive industry in our backyard, and when our sisters in South America and up in Alaska have the industry in their backyard, and we're right up there at front lines, we have no recourse for those that are in pain. In Oklahoma, it is the most imprisoned place in the United States. And a good majority of those are Native people or people of color or poor people. and a huge majority of them are Native women who are looking for a way to go forward. And so our statistics have been muffled and mismanaged and deliberately ignored since the doctrine of discovery, since Andrew Jackson as an Indian killer, since the time when the policy was to kill the women and kill the children, because that was the policy against Native people.
When we return, we hear how these powerful Native American organizers are taking action and building growing movements to end the violence against Indigenous women and girls. They say success requires knowing the true history and engaging the allyship of non-Native people. I'm Neil Harvey. You're listening to No More Stolen Sisters on The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature. The song you just heard is a prayer for missing and murdered Indigenous women, composed by Anton George for the West Shore Canoe Family of the Lummi Nation. You can find a link for the music video and explore more Bioneers radio programs, podcasts, and videos online at bioneers.org. For information on the National Bioneers Conference, please visit bioneers.org or call 1-877-BIONEER. For Indigenous peoples of the Americas, being an unperson dates back over five centuries to first contact. A year after Christopher Columbus claimed possession of the Americas, the Spanish crown invoked the doctrine of discovery. It was a religious and legal edict that sanctioned European monarchies by divine right to seize lands occupied by Indigenous peoples. The 1493 Papal Edict characterized Indigenous peoples as, quote, the lawful spoil and prey of their civilized conquerors, unquote. From the very beginning, the colonizers branded Indigenous peoples as subhuman and unworthy of rights. In 1792, then U.S. Secretary of State Thomas Jefferson declared that the doctrine of discovery would extend from Europe to the U.S. In 1823, the U.S. Supreme Court adopted it into U.S. law by unanimous vote.
The Catholic Church decided that if they came onto any of the territories where those of us who were in total touch with Wakanda and Mother Earth did not embrace Christianity, that they had the right to come into our territory that we were blessed to caretake, and take what they chose to take by just planting their little flag on there and saying, this is ours because you guys are savages. That began the destruction of our peoples and our women in particular. And that papal bull edict has yet to be rescinded. And that was the beginning of what was going on here that allowed people like Columbus, that allowed the extractive industry.
When there are societies of strong Indigenous peoples and there are people who are colonizing and they want to disrupt and destroy those societies, they understand that one of the first things they do is attack our women.
Simone Senegals, a member of the Red Lake Nation of Ojibwe, works on food sovereignty issues with a nonprofit Indigenous Environmental Network.
So that women who typically held positions of power, of influence, of decision making over all spheres of Indigenous life, our education, the raising of our children, our governance, our food systems, our politics, our spirituality, our families, all of those things, those women, they were disempowered and our society suffered. And so that connection between attacks on Indigenous women and the theft of our land is a very complex and yet sometimes very simple relationship.
According to Tejana historian Antonia Castañeda, within diverse Indigenous cultures, quote, women's power and authority were integral to and derived from the tribe's core religious and spiritual beliefs, values, and traditions, which generally accorded women and men equivalent value, power, and range of practices, unquote. Ozawa Benishi Albert.
For Indigenous people, matriarchal is not that women ruled. It's not the opposite of patriarchy, but there was a balance and leadership that women carried and held. Women held property or land or held the wealth of community. And in colonial times, trappers, people who wanted to like trade with Indian people, they didn't want to trade with women, right? So that shifted a power dynamic here in this country with women. And then you move forward to when they moved Indian people to reservations at different places and in Oklahoma where they did allotments. Many of those early tribes that came, women were not given allotments. Men were deemed head of households. And if you were a woman who lost your family along the walk or along however they got you and removed you, you had nothing unless you attached yourself to another family. And that kind of history keeps finding new ways and applications. It's happened with Navajo Nation and the way that women held property with their livestock and the livestock reduction programs. It had an impact on the power that women held. So when we talk about this, yes, we're talking about this from a context of how patriarchy and colonialism has a relationship to this epidemic that we're dealing with now. It is not a new practice. It is not a new policy even. Because even in this country, during the women's suffrage movement, that didn't include Indian women being able to vote. We didn't get a right to vote till much, much later. In our own homeland, not deemed as citizens or entitled to have a voice in our American politics. So that's our collective history and not just Indigenous people.
Even in those terms, if they told a story in a history book that was factual, which was rare, the Native woman was never even mentioned. And they certainly don't mention things like in Columbus's diary that 9-year-old Native girls were the favored ones to be sought after and captured and given for use.
Casey Camp Horanek.
And they certainly don't mention in the history books the stories that my aunties, sisters-in-law, mamas, and grandmas told about when they came through the village of the Ponca. I have to stick to the history that I know, how they picked up our kids by the hair, by their braids, and flung them in the back of the wagons, how they separated out the women and the girls to be utilized by the soldiers during the forest removal while the men were held at gunpoint and felt helpless. And they certainly didn't mention us in the films that I watched when I was a young girl. They would pick anybody that was slightly brown to play us. And if there was a woman in that was played, she was always very pretty, very scantily dressed, and very sexualized. The history, the herstory, was never one that had any kind of valid, strong woman like the women that I knew that survived all of those things that I'm talking to you about. I worry about you out there. I worry about the heaviness that you're feeling right now because of these stories. We're strong women. They're sitting on each side of me here. They'll help us to learn, help us to turn that corner where we regain and re-understand our own portion of balance and how to go about that and how to empower the men in our lives to honor, respect, and understand the sacredness of woman.
Simone Senegals of the Indigenous Environmental Network.
We just recently did a exercise with some of the women in our community where we Googled ourselves, not by name, but by Native American women or Indigenous women. And the images that came up are just hypersexualized, fetishized as Halloween costumes. And what we did in response to that, after we looked at those images of ourselves on the internet, we made a collage of our own selves. Mm. We printed out pictures of ourselves, of our children, of our families, of our communities, of our lands and our waters, and we reminded ourselves of who we are, defined by ourselves, and especially our responsibility to Mother Earth. Because we've said before, what happens to the body happens to Mother Earth. What happens to Mother Earth happens to our body. And so we're reclaiming that. And there's a lot of power for us as Indigenous women to remember what our roles and responsibilities are as far as taking care of Mother Earth. There's a lot of strength in that. And so the more that we understand our own ways of understanding, even concepts around ownership, our relationship to the land, our relationship to ourselves, we are strengthened.
In 2012, the hashtag MMIW campaign took off as part of the movement to educate the general public about missing and murdered Indigenous women. To offer people ideas for how to get involved, the nonprofit Sovereign Bodies Institute created a comprehensive toolkit for organizers. Ozawa Benishi Albert says that what's needed to make transformative change is the allyship of non-Native people.
What is then the collective responsibility to this? We're telling you a story about what's happening. We're doing our end of the work, and now we're asking you, what are you going to be able to do to bring this issue to the forefront? When VAWA comes up for reauthorization, as it does from time to time, don't throw us under the bus. When other gains need to be made, that you stand your ground and say, we're not going without the Indigenous women of Alaska. Bring this up with your police departments. We need citizens that look like you to say, hey, there's this crazy thing happening to Indigenous women. What are you doing as the sheriff, as the police chief, as the mayor, as a city council, and in particular states where there's high concentrations of Native people? Call and ask your state legislatures, what are you doing about this epidemic?
Candy White.
We have always traditionally and historically been the people that have held the homes together. We own the homes. We own the earth lodges traditionally and carried that role, which was a kind of more of a silent role. But now we've seen women standing up and rising up and saying, no more. We're not going to be the silent role. We have to have a voice. We have to have our own grassroots organizations and take a stand and maybe help pick up our men that lost their warrior status when the industries came and when colonization came, because we don't have a choice. We were forced into a role to pick up the pieces and to say, we're not going to allow this to happen anymore to our bodies, to our earth, to our own children. We're going to stand and rise up.
No More Stolen Sisters, Stopping the Abuse and Murder of Native Women and Girls. Executive Producer Kenny Ossabell, written by Monica Lopez and Kenny Ossabell. Senior Producer and Station Relations, Stephanie Welch. Host and Consulting Producer, Neil Harvey. Producer, Teo Grossman. Program Engineer and Music Supervisor, Emily Harris. Special thanks to production consultants Alexis Bunton and Kara Romero. My name is Neil Harvey. Thank you for listening. I invite you to join the Bioneers in inspiring a shift to live on Earth in ways that honor the web of life, each other, and future generations. This is program number 240.
Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the program.
Sea swimming season is almost upon us again. Some bathers are wary of swimming on beaches near to where seals congregate. However, there's little cause to be concerned. That's my belief, anyway. While I've had several close encounters with seals during my regular swims at the 40-foot in County Dublin down the years, my experiences have been uneventful. It's never been more than a curious seal pup playfully twisting and turning below me, or the occasional adult popping its head above the surface to see who's intruding on his trusted corridor to Bullock Harbour. By showing seals the respect they deserve and keeping your distance, by and large, everything ends up swimmingly. So says my friend and neighbour, Mark Leslie. Mark is a seasoned sea swimmer and seal aficionado. Mark cherishes being underwater, filming a plump of seals. It's why his fellow swimmers in Sandy Cove call him the Seal Whisperer. Mark assures me he's on first-name terms with what he calls the Wawoo tribe, a moniker he coined for the local herd of seals whose HQ is Doki Island. If Mark is not down at the 40-foot for his early morning dip, chances are he's over by the old baths, where sub-aqua divers gather at weekends, exploring the depths with his seal friends in Scotsman's Bay. He calls it the Seal Garden. There he swims with Beamish, Doris, et al., amid the green and orange fields of kelp. Other less energetic seals take to the nearby rocks, lazing in the sun and rolling about in slow motion. The Seal Garden is also a ballroom of romance for those in search of their ration of passion. Once Juliet adopts a banana pose and gets a little frisky on the rocks, Romeo knows it's time for action. When the deed is done, the couple perform a victory swim. They breach the surface of the water and jump into the air to let their Wawoo colleagues know they had a whale of a time. How easy is it to tell the seals apart? Well, when it comes to a bull or cow, size and shape determines that. A bull like Beamish is stout, dark, and has a white snout. Doris is, well, a lady, just like Doris Day. But how does the Seal Whisperer separate Doris from Brona, and Brona from Speckles? Mark tells me it's down to body markings and personality, how they behave in the water. The local herd of grey or harbour seals at Doki Island numbers around 50. They swim to and from Sandy Cove in channels, occasionally stopping off at Bullock Harbour for a snack. They can spend up to 30 minutes submerged. Mark understands why people might be nervous around seals. They are put off by how big they are in the water, particularly a bull, and how fast they move. Seals are territorial. Pups are highly inquisitive and find the actions of humans intriguing. It's advisable to avoid a cow when she has young alongside her in the water. As with any wild animal, if you're unfortunate enough to be bitten, even slightly, it's important to get a tetanus vaccine, as a seal's mouth is alive with bacteria. Can bathers and seals safely share the sea? First and foremost, Mark insists, people must remember that the ocean is the seal's home, and they know it. Having said that, should you find yourself close to a seal when bathing, move slowly. Stop in the water and face the seal like you would a dog. Don't turn your back and never kick out or make physical contact with a seal. If it's a beach or bathing area like the 40-foot, where seals are close by, one safeguard would be for swimmers to wear goggles, fins, or a pair of booties. Being the clever mammals they are, seals are aware of bathers and the gear they wear in the sea. By wearing goggles, you get to witness the wonder of a grey seal navigating the depths. Mark is convinced that any intentions seals have in relation to bathers are benign. They have incredibly sharp teeth, he says. If they wanted to be hostile to humans, they could wreak havoc, but they generally don't. So I'd share Mark's advice to anyone swimming in the sea this summer. Enjoy the company of seals. Be amused by their presence, but please don't seek them out.
A shadow rose from out the sea, cradling a newborn.
Search for a lady
to nurse the babe for 7 years, till he returns from whence he came. The
till this wee boy's heart beat cold.
Last autumn, we visited a rice farm near Vercelli. That's in the Po Valley, where over 50% of Europe's rice and almost all its risotto rice comes from. This particular farm was the setting for the 1949 film Riso Amaro, usually translated as bitter rice, though it's also a pun on bitter laughter. In the past, until mechanization took over, rice in Italy was planted and harvested by women known as le mondine. The word comes from the verb mondare, which means to cleanse or peel, because among their other tasks, they cleaned the rice fields of weeds. The women came from all over Italy for the rice season, 25,000 of them at the peak of production, and returned home afterwards, bringing their hard-earned wages to poorer regions. Needless to say, it was back-breaking work, and they spent the daylight hours up to their knees in water that was full of snakes, rats and leeches, and surrounded by clouds of blood-sucking mosquitoes. They sang songs as they worked, many of which were of the call-and-response form. The role of lead singer passed around from woman to woman, and often they invented new verses to record the events of the day. Since the workers were forbidden to talk, a rule enforced by male capos, who could punish them by deducting wages or reducing food, and in some instances beating them, this singing amounted to a form of illicit conversation. They sang of everything in their lives, their families waiting for them at home, their boyfriends, husbands and children, love, politics, the work in the fields, and their struggle for unionization and a better life. And the women didn't take their oppression lying down. Already in the late 19th century, they had begun to organize. The song La Lega, the League, begins with the lines, Se ben che siamo donne, paura non abbiamo. Even though we are women, we have no fear. You can hear this song towards the end of Bernardo Bertolucci's wonderful film Novecento, or 1900. And they were indeed fearless. Strikes and other forms of agitation for better conditions and wages were often put down with brutal force by gangs operating for the bosses, and even by the police and army. But the women fought on anyway, and they did win concessions. In 1903, the Cantelli regulations ordered that their work should begin not earlier than 1 hour after sunrise and end not later than 1 hour before sunset, that their bedding and shelter should be clean and comfortable, that the owners should provide them with clean water and sufficient food, and that no children under 13 could be employed in the rice fields. These regulations did not, however, apply everywhere and were widely ignored by the owners. Troublesome workers were fired, union organizers were beaten up or even killed. The owners, the hated padroni, tried to starve the strikers into submission. But strikes continued nevertheless, often involving the entire Po Valley and therefore the entire rice production of Italy. And eventually the government stepped in to regulate the work. Among the songs the women sang was one called Le Otto Ore, the 8 hours, an account of the harsh conditions the women worked under and a demand for what seemed impossible at a time when farm workers traditionally worked all the hours of daylight, an 8 hour working day. The women rice workers of Vercelli did win the 8 hour day, and it became law in 1909, 10 years before it became law for other workers in Italy. There are many other beautiful songs that the women sang, like Amore mio non piangere, My love do not cry, but the best known song to come out of this terrible way of life has to be Bella Ciao. We know it now in the form that developed among the partisans during World War II, now the official song of resistance all over the world. But it originates among the mondine, the rice workers. The definitive version is that by Giovanna Daffini, an Italian folk singer who sang it with authority, having herself worked as a mondina as a young woman. In the song, a girl wakes up and remembers that again today she must go to work in the risaia and face the brutal labour, the mosquitoes and the capo with his truncheon. She goes on to describe the misery of the working day. The words are both lyrical and heartrendingly direct. Oh, mamma mia, oh, che tormento. Hardly needs translation. The song ends, however, on a defiant note. The day will come, the woman says, when everyone will work together in liberty. Many, even most folk songs, have an international life cycle. Interestingly, the air of Bella Ciao is believed by some music critics to have developed from an even earlier Yiddish song, the first recorded example of which comes from Ukraine. It's appropriate that an air that may have begun in Ukraine, that was adapted to the struggle of women workers for their rights, and subsequently evolved into a hymn of resistance to fascism, should now come full circle to be sung again in Ukraine as a gesture of defiance against Putin's invasion. The last verse of the Mondine's song comes to mind. The day will come, they sing, when all of us will work together in liberty. Verrà il giorno che tutte quante lavoreremo in libertà. Bring on the day.
Alla mattina, appena alzata, oh bella ciao, bella ciao, bella ciao, 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 alla mattina, appena alzata, in risaia mi tocca andare.
I love islands. I love their sense of enclosure and completeness and isolation. I've spent time on several islands off our coast, but many years ago I had a day trip with a difference. My sister and her husband, both architects living across the Atlantic, phoned to say that on their next trip home, they'd like to visit Lambay Island, and could I arrange it? Sure, I said, without really knowing how to do it. Their interest was less in the island itself, but more in the work of Sir Edwin Lutyens, the architect who designed some buildings there. Lambay Island lies 5 kilometres off the east coast of Ireland, just north of Dublin City. It's about 2 square kilometres in size and is owned by the Baring family of banking fame. While it's possible for the public to visit it nowadays, back in the early 90s this wasn't the case. So, what to do? I decided to write to the then owner, Rupert Baring, otherwise known as Lord Revelstoke. I had heard him variously described as a recluse and an eccentric, so I didn't fancy my chances. However, I employed my most creative writing skills and wrote him a jaunty little note explaining that, personally, I couldn't tell a gandon from a gondola, but that I had in-laws and friends who were passionate about architecture, and Lutyens in particular. Would it be possible to visit his island home? His reply was prompt and positive. He would send a boatman to meet us at Rogerstown Pier in North County Dublin. On the day in question, a bright, cold April morning with a deep blue sky, a small group of architects and I shared our boat with 9 sheep, who were making the crossing at the same time. We could see a row of white coastguard cottages near the harbour as we approached, and the mound of island behind them. With appropriate good manners, we let the sheep disembark first and waited for Eileen, Lord Revelstoke's assistant, who would take us up to the house. The architect Edwin Lutyens, born in 1869 to an English father and Irish mother, was a good friend of the Baring family, in particular Maud and Cecil Baring, who bought the island in 1904, having seen an ad in the London papers. The island's main building at that time was a 16th century castle in need of renovation. For this project, the Barings called on their good friend Lutyens. The shy but convivial architect's great skill was to modernise old structures without spoiling their ancient beauty. We emerged from the harbour pier to a series of terraces which led upwards past the whitewashed cottages to the sheep-shorn grass of an open meadow. In front of us stood a high stone rampart wall. Within the walls, we were greeted by so many daffodils bowing and nodding that they would inspire even the most reluctant poet. The house itself was grey, with windows peeping out from beneath roof tiles which swept down low, like a girl's overlong fringe, in danger of obscuring her eyes. Inside, Eileen let us wander about, and my impression was of a labyrinth of corridors, with a surprise at every turn. A spiral limestone staircase, a glimpse of the vaulted drawing room. We were in the kitchen with its whitewashed walls, long oak ceiling beams, unvarnished floors, scrubbed pale silver, and all about, antique blue and white delfware. I was impatient to meet the owner. Just when we thought he was taking the recluse business to extremes, Eileen explained that his lordship was unwell, but that he hoped to meet us briefly later. While the others made sketches and took photographs, I noticed that, scattered around his home, in frames and in notebooks, were the writings of Lord Revelstoke, including a tribute to his mother which would warm any mother's heart, along with several humorous rhymes. I felt now I was gleaning a sense of this man's personality. Sadly, we never did get to meet his lordship, as he remained bedridden with the flu. In my thank you note to him some weeks later, I decided to write to him in verse. 'Twas on a Monday morning, the wind was blowing mean, we set off for Lambay, were met by sweet Eileen. I figured this would amuse him, as indeed it did. He replied to me in similar vein, a handwritten 16-line rhyme, which included much self-deprecation. Your friends made drawings of the art, and spent their time in bliss, while you, my dear, enjoyed your part by writing junk like this. His poem was signed Rupert Revelstoke. Unfortunately, our rhyming correspondence was short-lived, as Rupert Baring, 4th Baron Revelstoke, died in July the following year. One of his obituaries mentioned his verse writing, saying that Sir John Betjeman, poet laureate, had called it good doggerel. Now, I think, while I may not have glossy architectural coffee table books in my home, at least I do have some good doggerel in a frame on my wall.
The sea is quite rough, we sail out around Lambay, untie the tight lines, it's time to heave away. The sun is quite high, the deck's slowly drying.
In the spring of 1970, we swapped the smog-drenched streets of West London for the wilds of West Kerry. I was the youngest of four boys, all under the age of 10. My older brothers disappeared into the fields and onto the beaches of this new and vast playground. We rented a farmhouse while our bungalow neared completion. Our new house sat on a slight hill overlooking the bay, where lights twinkled in the distance when the sun descended. Later that summer, we moved in. My mother was apprehensive, though, because all was not that simple. We had a near neighbour. Well, when I say near, what I really mean is that he lived at the bottom of our garden. Bill was his name, and his tiny white house was tucked in behind a cluster of crabapple trees in what the deeds proved to be a separate plot. Bill was a tall, thin, bespectacled man, and he wore a long beige trench coat with a beige beret to match. When he first set eyes on the young English tearaways, his face turned even greyer. "I'm ruined," he declared. "I'm completely ruined." My father assured him that we'd keep our distance, but Bill remained wary. He ordered a wall to be built around his little house. Within weeks, he was barricaded in by a high white wall with a narrow crevice at its centre. This gap allowed him to slip in and out with ease, yet he seldom did. As that first summer fell into autumn, sightings of Bill were as rare as the sunlight itself. But when the winter loomed, he appeared again like an animal having gained an extra layer of fur. His winter garb consisted of a long black coat that touched his toes and a black beret now that hid the white hairs growing out of his ears. There were only two places Bill could be found. At the nearby Bay Hotel having dinner, or wandering the Strand Road to the beach below. He had been a teacher, or at least that's what my father heard, and he'd been sacked by the local parish priest amidst rumours of drink. Then he took off up the country somewhere, disappeared for years. Some said he went to England and fought for king and country, but the truth is nobody seemed to know much about the man. When the weather brightened, he began to appear again, back in beige attire, but looking even thinner now. My mother sensed his frailty, and I'm not sure when or how it exactly happened, but my father began bringing him his breakfast, and in the fading evening light, we'd place a dish of bread on his wall, but never went any further. We called out, "Bill!" before hearing his door open. Soon after, his bony old hands appeared, and like a bird, he carried the bread back into the nest before disappearing inside again. On warm days, he began sitting in a sun trap outside the wall. "The heat eases the pains," he'd say. He and my parents chatted more frequently. What they'd chat about, I'd no idea. But sometimes I heard the word doctor and hospital being mentioned in whispers, of course. I can still see my father helping this feeble old man into our black Volkswagen Beetle. I can still see the reg plate, JIE15. Still smell the fumes as it takes off towards the town. I wondered if we'd ever see Bill again. But some hours later there he was, in the passenger seat, as the car pulled up. They wanted to keep him in, but he wouldn't stay in, I heard my father say before he walked the ailing Bill to the wall's crevice, but went no further as usual. The bread was collected untouched from the wall each morning thereafter. The bird was surely facing his final hibernation. Now I'm following my mother through the garden and beyond the crevice of Bill's wall. She slowly turns the handle of his front door. I'm finally going to see what's inside. And seconds later, through the darkness, I see another door. It's a caravan. Bill has a caravan inside his house. How on earth did he get it in there? The curious child wonders. My mother keeps me back, and all I can see is Bill's legs. Bill's lying on the bed. "I'm dying, Joe. I'm dying," he cries over and over. "Shush now, Bill," she whispers. "Shush now." I don't remember an ambulance coming or how he was taken away, but days later, Bill died in the old Dingle Hospital. His parting words to my father, "Whatever I have now is yours, Sean. I'll have no more use for it." It was fitting that my father was the man to knock the walls that Bill had built around himself. For I doubt Manny got as close to Bill as he did. We broke down the gable and pulled the caravan back out into the light. It was cleaned and painted and passed on, with the ghost of Bill still inside, no doubt. His little white house still stands at the bottom of the family garden, still known as Bill's house. Bill the man in the beret. Bill like a bird who flitted in and out of his nest for crumbs. Bill who remains as much a mystery to us now as he did then.
Of sunlight.
I was introduced to beekeeping by the father of a good friend of mine. He was a retired military man who, when he spoke about bees, shifted into a curious and mysterious world occupied by queens, drones, workers, propolis, frames, smokers, an entire glossary of words with which he sought to convey the fascinating, ordered chaos of the hive to me. I was smitten. My beekeeper friend suggested that if I were really interested, I should attend a course in beekeeping. Encouragingly, he added that if I completed the course, he'd give me a hive. Who could resist such an offer? I located a course for beginners run by the Dublin Beekeepers Association. It seemed appropriate that the instructor was a cleric named Brother Bean. And 8 weeks later, after a crash course in beekeeping basics, which led me infinitely further into that magical universe, I was given a certificate and a blessing, the former of which I proudly took with me to my mentor's home as proof of having fulfilled my part of the bargain. He seemed a little surprised, but pleased, and, true to his word, he went out to his shed and returned with the main components of a beehive, minus bees. During the following weeks, I acquired a nucleus, or starter population, of bees, and went through the terrifying excitement of installing them in that first beehive. And so began many happy years of beekeeping, with my mentor always at the end of the telephone, should I need his advice. Sadly, about 15 years later, my beekeeper mentor passed away. His family contacted me to let me know that he'd hoped that I would inherit his bees, as no one in the family was keen on doing so. For those unfamiliar with beekeeping, the offer of two hives filled with bees at the beginning of summer is like gold dust. Beekeepers dream of such moments. So one May evening, I set off to collect the hives. Transporting beehives isn't an unusual practice. Beekeepers often move their hives from location to location to gather pollen and nectar from different plants as the honey flow progresses throughout the seasons. The hives are usually and preferably transported in an upright position. My problem was that the hives were of the large WBC kind, as they're known, the ones with the big pitched roof that you often see in photographs, but which are, at least nowadays in Ireland, rarely used as they're so heavy and cumbersome. It was immediately clear to me that they wouldn't fit standing upright in my low-roofed estate car. Thinking myself resourceful, I decided to seal the hive entrances with foam sponge and strap the various sections of the hive very tightly together before laying them horizontally in the back of my car. With a lot of strenuous heaving, which had to be done alone as my mentor's family were bee sting intolerant, I manoeuvred the heavy hives through the garden and then placed them as gently as possible into the car. I set off across Dublin to my home in Harold's Cross, a gentle, contented hum emanating from the rear of my car. I passed through Clontarf and Merino, and the buzzing seemed to get louder. In Fairview, the traffic grew heavy. The now distressed-sounding buzzing of up to 100,000 agitated bees grew in intensity, and it was then I heard the first bee alarmingly close to my right ear. I waved my hand at it, then again. Suddenly, there were two or more bees in my sight and flying close to my head. I swatted again. This time, a driver stuck in traffic going in the opposite direction waved back. As the traffic inched forward, more bees escaped the hives till a loud, cacophonous buzzing pulsated throughout the car. Bees were hitting the windscreen, landing on my arms and head, while I tried to fend them off. Meanwhile, more surprised but friendly drivers waved at me. By the time I reached the customs house, the interior of my car was a cloud of agitated bees. That's when they began to sting. My ankles, my arms, my shoulders all fell victim. I considered bailing out and simply abandoning the car, but the prospect of that humiliation prevented me. So, resigning myself to the pain, I continued driving and waving all the way across the Liffey, along the quays, up under the arch of Christ Church Cathedral, past St. Patrick's, and on to Harold's Cross. I can't recall how many times I was stung, nor how many passing motorists and pedestrians crossing the road waved back, some very energetically, mirroring my own frantic gestures. Arriving home, I realised that what had to be done immediately. I leaped from the car, my head and clothes a tangled veil of escapees, and opened up